You've talked for some time about how our current financial system is operating. You have called it the slow burn. Could you describe the slow burn? Now, a lot of what you've already said is a big part of it.
Right.
And you've also mentioned the idea that collapse, you don't foresee collapse happening. And really, the slow burn, would you describe it as sort of the opposite of the idea of collapse?
Well, the slow burn, imagine in your mind a balance sheet of all assets in the global economy. So on one side of the balance sheet, you have the assets. And on the other side of the balance sheet, you have the financial system and then the equity ownership. And what you're watching is financial assets are being subsidized by liquidating different assets. Okay. So whether it's war, whether it's covert operations, whether it's drug dealing, what you're doing is whether you're killing, stealing, or just sort of harvesting in a variety of ways, you're harvesting from the living systems to feed the financial assets. And the financial system right now is being used as literally a way to manage, incentivize, control, you know, the living systems on the asset side of the balance sheet. And the slow burn is my description of how you can manage the general economy so that you don't have a collapse, but instead you literally compost different parts of the assets or people to keep the game going. So what you've got is you've got a uneconomic system. It's not economic, but you are able to manage, and a lot of it works through the government budget. But it works through different cartels. You are able to keep the game going by literally stealing from some. You know, so some die, so others may live. And, you know, my other description of it is the tapeworm economy. So think of a tapeworm in your body. And the tapeworm is the system, and it gets bigger and healthier and whatever. And it just eats up the life of the host. And so a lot of the population is being tapewormed by this machinery. And the scary thing about this, Bonnie, is so many of us are part of the tapeworm. We're feeding the tapeworm. The way a tapeworm works in your body, it injects into you a chemical that makes you crave what's good for the tapeworm and bad for you. And the power that we have to change things is the day we say, you know something, I'm going to eat what's good for me and not what's good for the tapeworm. You know, that's step one of what I call coming clean. But the slow burn is the process by which the economy is managed. The way it works right now in the United States, a lot of it revolves around debasement of the currency. What you'll watch is this process of transitioning the middle class, is their incomes steadily fall and their expenses steadily rise. And when I say expenses, I don't just mean their financial expenses. The process of debasement works like this. Next year, the can of tuna fish costs 10% more, it shrunk 10% in size, and there's a 10% greater chance you're going to get food poisoning or some kind of disease because it's not, the quality control is diminished in a way that is invisible. You know, so, or you pick up the tomato and it's not a real tomato, it's a genetically modified thing that's really poison. You know, so debasement is this slow and steady process of lowering our purchasing power and the health of our environment and the systems around us in a way that we can trust. So we've literally watched a system which is slow burning the middle class in America, you know, down to a much, much smaller group of people, and doing it in a way which is lowering the life expectancies and is raising the fertility rates. So you're literally looking at a population that is under physical, spiritual, emotional attack. I don't know if you saw the latest statistic. This was up on my blog several weeks ago. Women without a high school education over the age of 60, I think, between 1990 and to date, their life expectancy has dropped 5 years.
That's dramatic.
Men have dropped 3 years. Well, that's how you balance the budget. So if you can't balance the budget through political means, if you lower the life expectancies, then that's how you balance Social Security and Medicare.
Yeah, and you also do what they're probably going to do, and that is sneaky things like changing the CPI or how they calculate the cost of living raises. sort of a hidden right. way of lowering what you get.
Now, but here's the interesting thing. So I'm going to defend their point of view. For many, many years, you saw many good people in the machinery in Washington try and do the right thing. Try to get the system to create or come up with a financially responsible solution. And all they got for their trouble was fired, laid off, you know, in a variety of ways. And it has been extremely difficult to get any political support for a financially responsible solution. So in the defense of the leadership, I have enormous sympathy because they've seen how much pain has been caused when they've tried. On the other hand, that's why I created the Community Wizard Tool. I created a software tool that would allow everybody to see the sources and uses of government money by place so that we could bring the federal budget down to a world where I could see. I could walk around and see and bring it down to a world that was intimate and I could understand. That's what you need if you're going to have financial responsibility by an individual citizen. They need to see a sources and uses of financial resources and other assets within the world that they walk around and vote for political representation. And if you look at the effort made to destroy Community Wizard and suppress it, there are two sides to this story. They don't want the average citizen to have the transparency they need to exercise responsibility. So, you know, on the other hand, while the leadership's been very frustrated by the refusal of people to behave in a responsible manner, the leadership would never permit the transparency that was needed if they were going to do that.
And your Community Wizard was software place-based so that you could look at what was going on in a specific location on
right.
many different levels,
right.
where the money was going, where the foreclosures were, and you mapped it all out, and it was actually visual,
right.
so you could just look at it.
Right.
Well, why don't you talk about what happened when you came out with this tool? This was when you had your company?
You know, the first thing that happened, because we were just building, it was remarkable, Bonnie, to watch people's faces, because suddenly they could understand their world. And we'd get somebody in front of, because Community Wizard was just, you know, it was very much in the early prototype stage, because relational database technology is just really blossomed and the internet had just blossomed. So this is very early on. And it was just a whole set of links and databases and then GIS software tools. So we had one, we're working on one tool where you could put in the ticker symbols for the Fortune 1000. So as long as it was in the Fortune 1000, you could put in the ticker symbols of the stock you own, and we would print you out a map showing you globally where your employees were. So you could start to connect the places, because here's the important thing. If we want the financial system to align with life, you know, life is about places. We live and work in places, and the environmental ecosystem is places. So you need the financial system. You need our financial ecosystems and our place ecosystems to be seen, and you need to be able to align them. So if I'm looking at a governmental budget, I need to see the governmental budget both by function. So I need to see housing, I need to see transportation, I need to see military, but then I need to see a crosscut, which is, well, what does that mean in Tulsa? What does that mean in Rhode Island? What does that mean, you know, in France? And that's what relational databases gave us the power to do. It gave us the power to look at things relationally. So we could look by function and then we could look by place and we could toggle back and forth, and then we could say, okay, well, how many mortgages are there in this neighborhood, and how does that relate to the mortgage-backed securities in the market? So we could toggle back and forth between global markets and local places, you know, and relieve this disassociation that currently exists. Now, the problem is you had decades of systemic fraud that depended on people not seeing, and that was the problem. So when Community Wizard first came out, we had all these amazing, miraculous situations where people would look at it and they would just say, wow, this is fantastic. You know, I can be a good citizen. Let me tell you one story. I had a partner in Wall Street who I was trying to interest in coming to work at Hamilton. And he flew down and we explained Community Wizard. We had all these big monitors up in our, we had very sort of high-tech offices. And this guy said, you know, we explained to Community Wizard, he said, this is stupid, this will never work. And we said, well, let's just show you. So we said, Luis, where do you live? And he said, oh, I live in Bronxville. So we pulled up all the numbers and maps on Bronxville. And he just exploded in Spanish. He was Cuban. And he said, this is so corrupt, this is terrible. And I said, what are you talking about? And the first item was $4 million a year for flood insurance. There's a lot of games in the flood insurance program, is my impression. Anyway, he said, Bronxville's on a hill. I've lived there for 30 years. There's never been a flood in Bronxville. This is totally corrupt. Anyway, so we gave him a printout of everything we had on, you know, sort of Bronxville and his area. The next day, I had a conference call with him. I called him at 10:30. I couldn't get through for hours, and this guy's always on time. Finally, I got through, and I said, Luis, you know, where have you been? He said, I have been on the phone with the deputy mayor of Bronxville for 4 hours. We have gone through these numbers one by one. He said, all this corruption is going to stop. I said, Luis, I thought you said it was hopeless. He said, that's before I got the numbers from my neighborhood. Because America's just 3,100 counties. You take that budget and you break it down to neighborhood, and what you're going to see is you're going to see millions of opportunities to re-engineer the money, which are unbelievably productive. But you need to get it down to a scale where you can affect practical change that's in the interest of you or your neighbors or your community or your municipality. You know, there has to be an incentive and there has to be a practical pathway.
Well, you did some very successful consulting work with the government, with the FHA.
Right.
And this Community Wizard obviously shined a light and made people understand in a concrete and visual way where the money was going.
Right.
But what happened?
Well, if you've ever seen the movie Enemy of the State, I played Will Smith in real life. So, you know, here's the thing. To have the housing bubble, they had to get the honest people out. And we were targeted in one of these sort of situations. And basically, you know, I'm watching what's happening right now, because right now, as we record this, we're watching a whole series of the military and intelligence leadership, particularly in and around the Middle East, get relieved of command by very dirty tricks. And it was the same thing. We were accused. There was a whistleblower, and you have to be careful of whistleblowers, because whistleblowers are oftentimes targeting and getting the honest people out.
Well, that's interesting.
Oh, yeah. No, it's people always say I was a whistleblower. Something. No, no, no. I was the target of a whistleblower. They got a guy who was making money on we had brought in a whole series of reforms, and that caused different contractors to stop making money on sort of running things the way they were. And so they had a guy who was losing business because of this, and they got, or I shouldn't say got, from what I can tell, HUD was financing him and encouraging him. But he brought a whistleblower lawsuit that was kept under seal for many years. Under the whistleblower lawsuits, it's supposed to be kept under seal for 60 days unless they can produce evidence. And they were never able to produce any evidence of wrongdoing. And it became very embarrassing because the judges extended and extended. We just happened to have the judge overseeing. It was the former general counsel of the CIA. How convenient. And it was extended and extended. The first judge said he wasn't going to extend it. It would be wrong to extend it. And he got very frustrated because they had no evidence of any wrongdoing. And he suddenly gets fast-acting cancer and dies. And that's when the general counsel, the former general counsel of the CIA, comes on. And he extends and extends and extends. And it was really funny because after 5 years, we finally worked very hard to get the transcripts out when the case got unsealed. And in the last year, the judge is going crazy, screaming at the lawyers because he's now extended this way beyond what the law permits. And they're not coming up with any evidence. And he's literally coaching them from the bench about how to falsify evidence. No, I mean, it was one of these, it's one of these wild shaggy dog stories that gets unbelievably complicated. And anyway, so this guy brought this lawsuit saying there's fraud and, you know, corruption in the HUD. We had a loan sale program was part of the work we were doing for HUD. Anyway, so he brought this lawsuit, and this was used as a pretext. What had happened was we had done about $10 billion of loan sales for HUD before the program was shut down, and had saved them about $2.2 billion. And the loan sale program was far from perfect. In fact, it was evolving in a better way. But on one of the loan sales, one of our subcontractors had made a mistake. And we had found it and reported it. And a year later, it was used as a pretext to fire us. And the interesting thing about this mistake was there was no loss of any money. It didn't cost the government any money. And in theory, if it gets complicated, if everything had worked perfectly, in theory, there might have made a little bit more money. But it was on a loan sale where they made a fortune. And we had done a very, very good job for them. So this was used as a pretext to fire us, and fire us in a context where you're fired for the convenience of the government, and which I support. I believe the government should have the right to fire anybody whenever they want, and just like private business. So we were just fired for the convenience of the government. We weren't fired for default. So a process ensued where we had two tracks, one where we sued the government to pay us for the money they owed us for the work we'd done. And we won that lawsuit in a what was considered to be a miracle. And then we went through this other track where we're being accused of all these things, and they keep trying to falsify evidence and find something wrong. It's a fishing expedition. They never can find anything wrong. And that got really dug in and bitter, because when they couldn't find anything wrong, they kept trying to settle, and I wouldn't settle because I wanted to force them into court. You know, it's like, okay, let's see what you got. And it was funny because my attorneys couldn't believe that this had gone on for this many years, and they had no evidence of any wrongdoing. And we went to court several times, and it was canceled the night before. You know, and that's to make it really expensive and exhausting. And then I'd refuse to settle, and we'd schedule another court case. So we finally went to court, and it was hysterical. The last attorney resigned. They put a new attorney on. I refused to settle. We came into court, and my attorneys were so prepared because they were sure they must have something. They had nothing. They had absolutely nothing. It was the most embarrassing thing I've ever seen. And the judge just laid him out because it meant he was going to have to rig it because they were giving him nothing to work with. And I've never seen a lawyer screamed at the way the judge screamed at him. And so we went through that process, and it's all up on the website. And, you know, sometime we should do something on Hamilton because it's so complicated. Anyway, so we won the big one. The day after the first day, my lawyers walked out, and their faces were just, they were in shock, and they said, there was nothing. They had nothing. I said, I told you. But it was like, we can't believe it was a bluff. All these years, this is, the whole thing is a bluff. I said, I told you. It was amazing. I had spent $6 million in 11 years in total on this thing. So you can imagine, that's a very expensive bluff. Anyway, so we went through that, and at the end, the judge pulled a dirty. Now, on just one of the counts, we won everything except one count. He pulled a dirty, which was the opposite of the Court of Claims. So then we went into appeals, and at that point, I'd proved beyond a shadow of a doubt they had nothing, and we'd won the big one. So then I said, okay, I'll settle, because if you look at the value of any potential settlement in dollars versus gold, the best thing I could do was settle and put it in gold at that moment. Then leave the whole thing in dollars.
Now, was your company destroyed in the process?
Well, I shut it down. So what happened was when I knew I had to litigate, we went in for a quick decision. When we didn't get it, then I knew I had to litigate. And here was the interesting thing, Bunny. I believed in that situation, this is a political fight. I'll just get a political solution. We'll solve it. And I couldn't broker a political solution, and I couldn't figure out why. Why was everybody so dug in? Why were so many people, you know, you clearly had behind it, somebody wanted to destroy me. Somebody wanted me in prison. Somebody, you know, there was an anger and vindictiveness behind it that I could never quite understand. And one of the reasons I wrote the Dylan Reed story was to lay out, you know, the backdrop on it, because there was an aspect to it that was personal. I mean, clearly a decision had been made in the beginning not to kill me, because it would have been very easy to just kill me and get rid of me. But they really wanted me to fail. And my estimate was that the government spent $45 million on this whole situation, the surveillance. We had 18 audits and investigations. We had 12 tracks of litigations. I mean, it was really a huge, expensive fight for the government. I mean, I know how much I spent. And so, you know, I just couldn't understand why it got that bad. And so I tried different ways of sort of settling it politically and couldn't. And when I realized, okay, in 1998, when they failed to, there were several attempts to try and frame us. They seized our offices, stole all the databases and Community Wizard. It took me 6 years to get it back, and by the time I got it back, the most important pieces were stolen forever. They were just stolen. You know, it was sitting under court control, and it was just stolen. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
It was interesting. The litigation contractor for the Department of Defense was the leading provider of GIS software to the U.S. government. So it was basically a competitor who was managing some of the data for the Department of Justice. So I assume, you know, they just gave it to them. And if you look at some of the products the government and the Department of Justice came out with, I'm assuming they used a lot of our stuff and gave it to a variety of private companies who then developed stuff like that. So I think it was just stolen and used.
Now, what you were doing and why they came after you was because you were making the government money and it was costing some of the people who were making a lot on the fraud, it was costing them their contracts, right?
Well, there are a couple of issues. And here's the issue, and it comes down to if you look at a county by place, so if you look at how all the money works within a county level, both private and public money, what you'll find is that the private sector is making money because the public sector is losing money. We're putting money into a community, and that money has a negative return on investment. The government budget money. So, for example, at HUD, I will spend $250,000 to build and construct an apartment in Hope 6 public housing, when I could take that $250,000 and buy and rehab four or five single-family homes out of the FHA foreclosure property. So I'm spending four to five times as much as I need to get one housing unit.
Right.
Okay. Now, that's not economically efficient, but that produces fees for my friends. Mm-hmm. That engineers the money in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And so you're talking about, we've had 70 years of fees for our friends. And what that has done is that has created a society where we've built lots of fragile political coalitions and paid everybody off by, you know, printing more money. So we round up the kids, we throw them in jail, we have them do contracts for the Department of Defense. It costs $154,000 per kid per year, but we're funding it with government money and issuing lots of debt. So it's economically insane, but it gives you control. Those kids are off the street and they're not questioning about why you're doing what you're doing. And you can use them to run your drug business without them getting smart, because you just turn them over, you cycle them back into prison. So we're financing control. And the other thing we're financing is the black budget. We are watching trillions and trillions of dollars disappear, just disappear, whether it's going to finance an endowment for world government, whether it's a tithe to somebody on the moon, whether it's, you know, building the kind of machines that can do weather control and induce earthquakes and, you know, electromagnetic scalar weapons and weapons from space and space fleets and, you know, who knows? But the black budget and using government money to control and broker political solutions as opposed to optimize economics is stealing the wealth of this planet. Those two things are a giant sucking sound on our general economy. And that's why I come back to this question of uncertainty. Who's doing this and why are they doing this? Because if you look at the numbers tell you a very different story than any story that you come up with in terms of a problem solution. What it says is, it's funny, I live in a county that's very, very segregated. And you know, I'm in Tennessee and we've got the white folks and the black folks. And what I'm always saying to them is, look, if you would just bring transparency and collaborate about the money, you could hate each other rich instead of hating each other poor. You know, because the amount of money that has disappeared, it is a testimony to the hard work of this country and the geographic resources of this country that we are still standing. You know, it's a miracle we're all alive, given what's been going on, because the amount of wealth that's being pulled out is incredible. It's incredible. And that's why, to me, it's worth looking. I was just, we did a financial salon down in Santa Cruz, and Kimberly Carter Gamble, the producer of Thrive, was there, and she's such a dear. She said, you know, she was talking about going through the process of making Thrive, and she said, you know, the reason I'm an optimist is I've looked at all of this. I've looked at what's really going on. I've explored all the darkest side of the universe. And once you see all of that, what you realize is we have no economic problem. There's enough wealth for all, you know, and the earth creates this huge harvest every year. So
isn't that something?
Yeah.
Isn't that sad?
Yeah. Well, we have a political problem, and we have a political problem that we don't understand. And what I say is all of us together, working together, can bring transparency to that political problem and can figure out real solutions. But we need to bring transparency to it. And if we try and craft solutions without bringing transparency to that, we are going to have a mess. So it's very baffling what's going on.
And bringing transparency to what is going on within the current situation, as you've just explained from your own personal experience, that's quite something.